John Lloyd is one of Britain's most esteemed writers, producers and directors. He's been involved with such shows as Blackadder, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, The News Quiz and Spitting Image. But what I wanted to know was, what's he drinking?
Is it espresso then? Is that your poison?
I normally have espresso, but I've decided to...
Oh my God, you've adulterated it.
No, it's a flat white.
It's a very new thing, a flat white. I don't really understand it. Is it just a white coffee, a flat white? Dan will know. He's young and thrusting.
I have a horrible suspicion it is.
What's flat about it? Dan, answer us. What's...
I think it means it's not that frothy, probably, is it?
It's sort of a half latte, isn't it? But you're right, it's not been aerated, so it has none of the fun. None of the cappuccino
that
fun.
Like, it sounds like an Irish dancer, Michael half latte, doesn't it?
What's the bun?
It's an almond croissant.
You see, the thing is, you can eat that.
It's so funny that you bring up the eating, because I was just thinking about that yesterday, and... this is like being on Desert Island Discs with Kirsty, you know. It goes straight in with the heavy question that
you're
totally not expecting.
What are your comestibles of choice? I'm always fascinated by what people eat and when.
Yeah, I mean, I forget to eat quite often.
That doesn't surprise me because you're someone who, it appears to me, lives a lot in your own head.
Yeah, that's very true, very perceptive. Yes, I do, yeah.
So there's a sort of interiority and then I presume there's this sudden... spasm of pain in the belly area and you go, I forget I must be fed.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it's pretty erratic, I think. I always notice, because I've just come back from holiday, that on holiday you get, you know, regular meals and you eat well, because if you're in the Mediterranean you have that sort of diet.
Yeah.
And you suddenly notice, oh, this is the way normal people are.
As opposed to wake up. What is the normal routine? A wake up and a cigarette? Do you start with a cigarette?
Are we allowed to say that?
Well, you are. You're like...
Yes, I know it's not... I'm not proud of it.
I used to. When I smoked, I would always start the day with a cigarette.
I was hypnotised a few years ago to give up, you know. And...
I'm just laughing at the idea of you going into hypnotherapy. I don't know why that's so funny to me.
I do have a very funny story about it. I'll tell you later, but it's too rude to broadcast.
I don't know that
and
it is.
And too tasteless. Yeah, no, it is.
Is it? Yes, you're self-censoring, John.
Yes. But no, I didn't think... I was one of those people who thought, I can't be hypnotised. You know, you've got this sort of absurd idea that you might have a strong will or you're too intelligent or something like that. It's nothing to do with that hypnosis. And I went out, bing, like that. And I went in a heavy smoker. And came out 40 minutes later, I didn't smoke. I didn't smoke at all for 6 months. And I didn't miss it. It was really brilliant. And the hypnotist said, if you take up hypnosis and you can't hypnotise someone to stop smoking, you're in the wrong job. Because it's the easiest thing you can do as a hypnotist, apparently.
Really? I mean, I that's how I quit. I mean,
and
I... Yeah, and I quit, 12 years ago.
Okay.
So I went in and said, I'm not suggestible. And which is a ludicrous thing now I've said it out loud, and I'm one of the most suggestible people I've ever met. And the same thing, this guy just said, well, you're a creative person, so it's going to be really easy. You're going to just, fall like a dead tree. And I did. And I didn't even think that I hadn't had a cigarette for the first week. And then a friend of mine asked me to go, we stopped for some petrol, asked me to go in and get her a packet of fags. And as I came out, she was laughing at me, and I realised I was holding them with my elbows. I couldn't hold the packet with my hands. What's that about? Did you, as you were being hypnotised, were you aware of what he was saying to you?
It was a she, but yes, I was. I was aware. I was in a different state, but I was awake. You know, I was conscious, I think, or maybe sort of dozing off in that sort of hypnagogic state.
Yes.
Where you sort of
twixt
you
worlds.
Think you're not really asleep, but you are, and. Anyway, I came out and I was, I was able to do anything. I could go to the pub. I could, direct films. I could do more or less anything, social or worky, without any problem at all. I could even give speeches, as long as I didn't have to write them. Because I found that if I had to write anything, it was longer than two sentences. My chest was like confined in an iron band and I couldn't operate and I started to panic.
As a result of hypnotherapy?
So I didn't write any emails for 6 months to speak, just short ones.
And if Twitter would have been the ideal medium for you in this stage.
Yeah. And I could do a speech if it was literally, you know, three-line notes. I couldn't write it. And then I had to write a QI book. And I couldn't do it. I'd sit at the keyboard and my fingers would freeze and I'd have this kind of choking sensation, you know. So I rang up the hypnotist and said, look, I've got this problem. And she went, ooh, that's weird. I've never come across anything like that. You'll have to come in at least three times a week. I'm going to have to do some real deep excavation here because I've never heard of that before. And so I didn't particularly want to be deeply excavated. I just wanted to give up smoking. So I had to decide, stop smoking or stop writing. So I opted to take up smoking again.
And that cured it. The moment you lit a cigarette, you had no chest pain.
it is an irony.
You're a medical miracle, John. Yeah. And what do you think that was about?
I think it's about I was a writer performer, rather like you, came out of Footlights, and I didn't make the cut for Edinburgh because I'd ruined two serious plays at Cambridge by getting laughs, which I didn't mean to. And the Footlights always had, in those days, you had to take up, you know, you took a Chekhov as well, or an Ibsen.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and you all had to be in, all the cast of Footlights had to be in a serious play as well.
But that's a nightmare waiting to unfold.
Yeah, well, it's certainly, that's what the director thought, because I'd ruined Yeats's The Death of Cahulain and La Machine Infernale by Jean Cocteau. And I got a bit of a rep at Cambridge for go and see the idiot playing Anubis, the jackal-headed god, in La Machine Infernale. So he took me out of Edinburgh and said, and I was going to get terribly upset. So he said, well, we've been asked to do a radio show as well, so you can do that, a kind of consolation prize. So I fetched up in radios a sort of, you know, in the writer's room. And then this guy came in and said, would you like to be a producer? And I said, no, not really. And
he just came and said, would you like to be a producer?
Yeah, pretty much.
Were the days.
I had a suit. I was so poor. I had a suit, but nothing else. I was really, really poor. And so I said, I want to be a writer. And he said, you can write as well. You can be a trainee producer and a staff writer. How about that? So I was broke, so I agreed. And then you're just literally chucked in the deep end. So I used to be a writer on a show called Late Night Extra. It was three shows a week. And on the Friday night, I used to write a little funny 5-minute piece for the presenter. So Esther Ranson was one of them. I think we had Simon Bates, Brian Matthew, people like that, John Dunn. And I'd write them a funny, you know, thing. And one Friday, the producer was a guy called Chris Searle, who went on to be on That's Life.
And In at the Deep End, didn't he?
Yeah, and he suddenly said, OK, you're producing tonight, John. So, what? He said, there's the seat, you know, you've watched me do it long enough. And so it was 2 hours live on Radio 2 with absolutely no training and no experience. And so it became, it was a lot of, everyone who spoke to in those days in the BBC and drank, you know, everyone was, you know, sozzled old, you know, lunchtime obooses. And it was great fun. But the pressure of being 22 and having to turn out, you know, three shows a week of all different kinds meant that I associated smoking with ability to operate at all, I suppose, and it stuck.
So it's, and I know a lot of writers who feel the same way, that they say, well, I can't quit because this is as important to my writing process as a pen is or a keyboard is. It's the necessary adjunct to creativity. And their subconscious has sort of fused those two things, smoking and producing, I mean, in the wider sense. So maybe that's, I certainly think I was like that, and obviously you were like that, but it works for you. And ultimately, you know, rather that than a pain in your chest. And I mean, the idea that you, I find it interesting that someone like you would not be able to write more than two sentences. I mean, that's critically difficult for you, as you're a natural expressor, you're a natural communicator.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, it's all thoroughly odd. But then, you know, 20 years doing QI, including all the research before it started, that's the way the universe is. I mean, everything about it is extremely odd and miraculous and strange to the max. You know, and my younger daughters, I don't know, in the last couple of years, she suddenly got tuned into this. She says, Dad, a raspberry. I mean, amazing, you know. And Harry, my son, he broke his back in a skiing accident a few years ago and spent... He spent a whole day staring at an orange, going, ooh, whoa. He often
they're
tells
very
the story.
Fruit-centric, your kids. Yeah,
but and it's amazing that people do go through life in a state of sort of trapped in a sort of, you know, miasma of boredom and mild resentment and fear and stuff, rather than going, whoa, a table, look, this is amazing, because they all are, you know, at a subatomic level, a table is an astonishing thing.
And that's part of the wonder of QI, just appreciating the majesty of the world. But it seems to me that it's a sort of show and tell. It feels, what I love about it, is there's a feeling of being at school, of being very young, and somebody bringing in an object. It might be an object from their travels or an object they found at home, but it's something cherished. And you do this in the Museum of Curiosity, yeah. Obviously, notably. And it's that ability to associate that, the joy of learning, with also the joy of feeling young and youthful. And that's what I love about, particularly museum, actually. I think it's such a joyful listen, because it's like, I've got a thing I want to tell everyone about. And that's what knowledge should be, and particularly in an age where knowledge is derided and obfuscated and sometimes just not utilised at all. It's a wondrous thing.
It's the heart of QI is how astonishing ordinary things are. And sometimes we drift to the sort of, you know, here's a weird, eccentric 18th century guy who had three legs or something.
Yeah.
Sort of one-off weirdness. But I often say about, you know, every four-year-old is inveterately curious, insanely curious. You know, if you've ever taken one to the cinema, you know, what's he doing, Dad?
Why?
I don't know. I've just got here like you, you know. What's she doing there? I don't know. Or a leaf, you know. Daddy, a leaf! And you go, yeah, leaf, Jesus Christ. But actually, leaves, I don't know, this is a QI fact.
Go on then.
The leaves of the world every day produce 6 times as much energy as the human race has used in the entirety of its existence. So that's how amazing a leaf is. I mean, they are astonishing machines. And anyway, so kids are all like this, a pebble, a leaf, you know, a puddle. And then somewhere about 8, they sort of lose it and they become kind of, you know, anxious knowles, or, you know, or people who don't think that knowing anything is important or whatever. It's a very odd thing.
But why do you think that is? Why that switch from boundless curiosity to a kind of... I'm just going to be sort of more self-contained now and not ask so many questions.
I don't know. I mean, I think one of the biggest questions of being a person is, why haven't the human race got any better at being human beings? I'm seeing a talk by Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal in Oxford, and he brought that up. You know, because of all the technology that we can do and, you know, get to the moon and all that kind of stuff, and yet you still can't keep a marriage together. You still can't not lose your temper with a three-year-old. It's really odd. And hence you get this sort of cyclical nature of history. We seem to be going through a bit of a potential downturn because, you know, the sort of... your perception of history, isn't it, that things are getting better all the time, but that isn't the way it works. It goes in lurches, you know. You get a century where everything goes horribly wrong.
And you say, what is getting better? I mean, of course, we now have drinking water and we now have, you know, cures for various diseases and we can inoculate our kids and all the rest of it, what is the metric of progress?
Yes, and why aren't people grateful for those things? Why don't they go, this is, you know, that... You know, if you were, you know, in a helicopter crash in the Sahara or something, and a glass of water, if you escaped, would be just the most amazing thing. As Mark Twain, I think, said, I wonder how much a soap bubble would be worth if there were only one of them in the world. You know, that's, the mystery and the magic of very ordinary things that we sort of take for granted.
Is it just the... is it just the proliferation of things? Is it just the readily available nature of them that means we just switch ourselves off to the magic and the gratitude?
Yeah, I don't know. And I think the other thing is, which I feel about myself, is that having read an awful lot of philosophy and psychology and physics and everything else, and I've got far too much information, and the miracle of existence doesn't attach itself to me, you know. So I can do the talks and the work and be astounded when I'm absorbed in QI research. Like last series was the Q series, and there was quite a lot of concern in the research team that it would be too difficult, because almost no nouns begin with Q, you know, once you've done queens and stuff, and there's like four or five animals and birds. So I did, for my own pleasure, 380 pages of research of only things beginning with Q. That was absolutely fascinating. But that doesn't mean that I can, you know, say that it doesn't, that sort of doesn't help me be a better person, really, which is really what we should all be concentrating on.
What would help you be a better person?
Well, if I had a better personality, but I'm saddled with this appalling...
That's just so not true, though, John.
No, but the thing is, you've got to... It's like that... What's that film? Inside Out, is it called? Something like that. I definitely think it's like... there used to be a cartoon strip in something like... Was it the Beano called The Numbskulls?
Hmm.
And it was a bunch of little guys who operated all the levers inside somebody's head. A sort of early Inside Out, really. And I definitely feel like that. I feel that I'm being operated by something.
So there's constant existential crisis going on then, for you?
No, not constant, because the trick is to be, you know, in flow, as they say, to be in the moment. I mean, this is why what sounds like, you know, New Age bullshit, the thing about being in the moment is it's like... There is only that place to be, because the past you can't change is gone and the future may never happen. So you're always in the moment. But you know this as a creative person, that thing when you're so inside the thing, you know, whether you're acting or whether you're... For me, I used to get at film directing. I'd just forget what the time was and it'd suddenly be 2 a.m. and I'd, you know... And that's when the paradox of it all is you're most yourself when you're not there.
I agree with that entirely.
So what you think of as yourself is the little chattery person in the head going, I can see yours going, he's, oh, God, I wish he'd get onto the jokes. Why isn't he telling jokes?
I'm not thinking that at all.
He's supposed to be funny.
No.
But, you know, that interior monologue that we all have that actually disables us. And when you're doing something you love, drawing's another thing I love to do. It's very hard to get into the zone. And when you're in it, it's like meditating, you know. You're not thinking at all. You're just being. Totally conscious, and the personality is totally absent, and that's very refreshing for me.
So, yes, the paradox being that once you have no personality, your personality is just sublimated in task, you're most fully and uniquely you.
And also most uniquely everybody else. I mean, because that certainly my core belief, and this is actually in the papers yesterday, there's a new theory about that consciousness and the cosmos are intimately related and you can't have one without the other. Because consciousness is the big mystery of... the biggest mystery of existence is what is it? Where does it come from? And I'm very sort of Hindu about this. I think that consciousness is what they say is the ground of being, that the only thing that actually is consciousness. And everything else could be easily be a matrix, an illusion, a massively clever movie. But the one thing we know, as Descartes said, is I think, therefore I am. I mean, the one thing I know is true is that I am conscious. Whether you're conscious, whether in fact you even exist, I don't know. I could be dreaming. So when you're totally yourself, as it were, you connect in a strange way. It's why a great conversation's so absorbing. Because the little chattery guy, when you're completely concentrating and focused and engaged in what the other person's saying, there's silence inside, isn't there?
Yes.
And then there's a pause and the chatter starts again.
How does your consciousness then merge with mine? Because presumably the Hindu notion being that there's a universal consciousness and that there's a sort of, there's an ebb and flow of our essence.
Yes.
So I suppose in that frame, you would have to acknowledge my consciousness, wouldn't you, in order for us to sort of merge as part of a greater whole?
Well,
are you just refusing to acknowledge my consciousness, John?
No, but the thing is, it's Georges Braque, the great painter, said towards the end of his life, he was able to bridge the subject-object divide. He couldn't distinguish himself from the vase of flowers or the guitar that he was painting. He was the thing. And, you know, do you know that book, Zen and the Art of Archery?
Yeah.
You know, the archer becomes good when he gets out of the way of the arrow finding its natural home in the center of the target, you know. And this is another thing about being a more optimal person, is that getting out of the way. I did a show in Edinburgh a couple of years ago, which is about the meaning of things. So I'm sort of slightly in there, but it's a very good rule of life: get out of the way.
Hmm.
You know, that it's in the Tao Te Ching that a leader is best when people barely know that he exists. So that when the task is done, the people will say, we did this ourselves. You know, a light hand on the tiller is very good management skill, sort of micromanagement. And as a parent, you know, I've learned this far too late. My children are all in their 20s. But if I'd known then what I know now, I'd have said there's the only thing to do with kids is be there and be nice. It's not about telling them what to do or creating boundaries. It's about just encouraging them. And asking if they need help, give it to them, and give them without stint everything, and you know, just pay attention. These are such simple ideas, and of course, you know, you'll get screams of people howling about that's bad parenting and things, but it's amazing. Was it Woody Allen who said 90% of success is turning up?
Yes.
I think you turn up and let things unfold.
But it goes about being present, isn't it? It's about trying not to remember your kids yesterday or be anxious about what potentially their tomorrow holds, but just being in that moment in their need, in their questioning and in that space.
Well, I think certainly it was my experience of a parent was that you think you're doing it on their behalf, but actually it's all about you, really. Exam scores are more about your shame that your child hasn't got an A rather than caring about what they might feel about it.
But do you really have that? Would you really have that shame?
No, not well.
Because in most people, it'd be about their own, you know, wanting a child to get an A because they didn't get an A. But I assume you've got all
the A's. Can I just say, as my psychiatrist, I think you're only allowed to say, and how did you feel about that?
Yes.
You're talking far too much for a shrink.
That's true. I will sit back. But, you know, the classic trope is, I want you to do really well at school because I didn't. Whereas I assume you excelled at school.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not because I have no idea why. I never...
Well, I've got a fairly good idea why.
No, well, I don't know. I just didn't find the work terribly difficult, I suppose, or terrible. But I always thought I'm going to fail this exam because I haven't really understood it. And then I kept getting A's and things. And I honestly thought I'd failed all my A-levels. But
because you were operating on a slightly higher plane than
No, not a higher plane. I'm not. The fact that I've read a lot of books in the last 20 years, I'm just retailing, you know, things that I've found out that other people have thought of and putting them together into a sort of basket of, you know, pastries for you, if I may put it like that. It's actually, if you've got a good memory and you can concentrate and you know, a lot of schooling is just repeating back what you've been told.
What about those for whom quotation and fact and data sort of storage is not so easy?
Well, yeah, I've got, you know, three kids and they all learn differently and in different ways, but as do we all. And the thing is, it's obviously, you can imagine, because of QI and because everyone here, I would say that we pretty much all think our proper education began when we started doing QI research, because, you know, there's some very, very bright people down. Well, they're all bright,
yeah.
But there's, you know, people who got first from Oxford, and there are people who have never been to university at all. But they all, the way we think and learn is the way I think everyone should be taught, which is start with something interesting, and then the kids go, what? Why is that? And you say, well, I'll tell you why. And they say, but why is that? And you go, I often, in this show, I was telling you about I did at Edinburgh. I tell this thing about when my son Harry was very small, and he said, we're going to school one day, and I was holding his hand. He's about four or something, five, might have three. Small, very small boy. And so we're going along, and he says, Dad, who's that man? So which man? Has that man getting into that car? Well, I don't know, Harry, I don't know him. Why is he getting into the car, Dad? Well, he's probably going to work, Harry. It's, you know, worky time now. Yes. Why is he going to work, Dad? Well, you know, he has to go to work to earn money. Why does he have to earn money, Dad? Well, Harry, he has to earn money, Harry, because if he doesn't, his wife and children will all starve to death. Get me? And Harry says, Dad, yes, why do things want to live? And you go, oh, dear. Whoa. Now, if a four-year-old can ask that sort of question, what on earth are we wasting time teaching them, you know, what my friend Helen Fielding used to call the exports of Harwich? You know, it's like statistics that you can obviously now look up online that you're supposed to remember, and that somehow if you can remember a lot of information that you don't really understand, the three types of rocks, you know, igneous, metamorphic and sedimentary, then you get an A for that. But actually, most people who know that don't even necessarily know what the word igneous means.
Grass & Co. is a premium range of products that blend the highest quality 100% natural CBD with therapeutic botanical ingredients. The organic CBD and botanical formulations have been specially created to bring balance to your body and mind with the most delicious, smooth flavours. The new Grass & Co. Calm CBD range includes balancing botanicals Evening Primrose, Ashwagandha, Chamomile, Marula and Mint to help relax your body and calm your mind. Now, many people who've already tried CBD oils think that the challenging taste is just something you have to put up with to enjoy the benefits, but the guys at Grass & Co. disagree. They've blended their CBD with organic botanical ingredients including ginger, turmeric, orange and mint for the most delicious smooth flavours. If you're new to CBD, the best-selling 500mg Calm CBD oil is a great starting point. As with all supplements, CBD will affect everyone differently. So start low and steadily build your dosage every day so you find the balance that works with your body. The Grass & Co. Calm range brings peace and tranquility to your day with CBD consumable oils, nourishing body oils and peaceful pillow sprays. Comforting aromatherapy scents have been specially blended to quieten your mind and soothe your body. The Grass & Co. complete range delivers exactly what you need when you need it, whether that be taking the CBD oil first thing in the morning to prepare for a busy day at work, or at the end of the day, the aromatherapy scents can help reduce sleep anxiety and establish the habit of falling asleep. Simply spritz the Calm pillow spray generously onto your pillow and bed linen. Inhale the pure aromatherapy scent slowly and deeply to welcome a deep, restful sleep. And now, listeners to this podcast can get 20% off the full range. Just head over to www.grassandco.com/hour. Grass & Co. are the CBD wellness experts and are committed to delivering the best product range to their customers. Quality and integrity drive their approach to everything they make and do. They openly share the certificates of analysis with customers on website product pages. With no trace of THC, Grass & Co.'s CBD oils are totally legal to buy and consume within the UK and most EU countries. I've tried them and they're great. So get 20% off the full Grass & Co. range by going to www.grassandco.com/hour and entering hour at checkout. Grass & Co. Life enhanced by nature.
As you say, people process information in different ways. For me, I process information through feeling.
Do
so
you?
I remember things that are meaningful, that touch me in some way. So I just read a book about trees, and I remember pretty much every word on every page.
Was it The Hidden Life of Trees?
Which, yeah.
It's a great book.
Because it's profoundly moving.
It's marvellous, isn't it?
It is, because it's essentially, obviously, a metaphor for humanity, but this extraordinary exchange on a molecular level between these vast, towering specimens that will outlive us by hundreds of years. And the idea that for a tree, going slowly is the best way, is the way to ensure longevity, is the way, and it cuts across everything that modern life teaches us. We have to rush at everything, experience everything. participate completely and burn ourselves out. And I remember all the little facts about the fungi and the beetles and the, because as I was reading it, I was emotionally taken. And I think you're exactly right. The school system teaches statistics and successfully teaches statistics to people for whom that is an appropriate mode of learning. And there are so many other kids who just go, it's not meaningful to me. If you apply those statistics to a story or something, you'd find suddenly the class would be almost entirely engaged, I suspect.
Well, you know, I'm imagining this QI school for years and years and years, and I know exactly how it would work, and you should definitely be the head teacher.
I would love to be.
Because that's exactly, I mean, Plato... Here I'm quoting everybody, but Plato said early education should be a form of play. That way you will be better able to discover the child's natural bent. And what I would do is, you know, I'd have the kids play for 2 years and watch them and say, oh, she's going to be a mathematician, or I'm a Dutchman, or and that guy there, he's an actor, and this person's a musician, and so on.
Mm.
And then you would only competitively examine, if at all, the children in their chosen field. So the people already engaged and loved the subject, they could do proper exams and everything else. They'd have to do all the other lessons, but all the other lessons would be fun. So if you were, let's say, a natural linguist, you know, you'd learn probably several languages. Mm. But you wouldn't have to do maths in any sort of exam way. You go to maths, but they wouldn't make you do the things that I used to cry trying to do my times tables. They had to send me, my parents sent me to the Isle of Wight for 3 weeks with a fierce little old lady who banged them into me. You know, she just made me learn them until I knew them off by heart. So I'm more or less anumerate. But because of Q, I started getting interested in maths from the story point of view, you know.
Same with me, the philosophy of mathematics is, yeah.
Or that Leonard Euler was blind, for example, and, you know, or that Napoleon invented a mathematical theorem, and, you know, so that you learn the maths by accident, by inference, which is the whole idea of QI, is you're so interested, you don't even know you're learning. You're not being told, no, you've got that wrong. Do this, do that.
There is no wrong. But also I like the idea that... And this is evidenced in QI as well, and could be part of your QI school, that the teacher doesn't know everything.
No.
That old 1950s notion of the sort of the strict head teacher who's a font of knowledge, and there's no margins outside of what they know is doesn't exist in your world, because it's like if a kid comes to you and says something interesting, you take it on and go, I love that. And I'm going to read up about it.
It's so true. Somebody said, I forget who it was, the mark of a good teacher is someone who can elicit from the class a question that they themselves cannot answer. And that's when you know people are engaged, because they're asking why.
Like, why do they want to live? Exactly, yes. That question. How did you answer that, by the way? Did you come up with an approximation, or did you just let it hang in the air?
I'd never thought about any, you know... If I'm coming on as some sort of ridiculous Greek philosopher or something, I mean, I hadn't thought about anything like that until I was 40-odd, you know, which is about that sort of age. And it was actually the kids who sort of tilted me over into this appalling crisis of... which was first a horrible shock of realising I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything at all. I couldn't have possibly described the structure of an average atom or if there is such a thing. I didn't know any physics or any science at all, really.
And it was their questioning
that prompted
you to make... Yeah.
Well, that was what one of the things. Another question that Harry asked years ago was, Dad, why is there something and not nothing? Which is, again, such a profound question. And first asked by Leibniz, Gottfried Leibniz, the co-inventor of calculus.
Of course you know the answer.
And Harry was, I don't know, 12 or something, you know. It's... And it's such a shame, isn't it? Obviously, the capacity of ordinary children to ask questions of this magnitude and our hopeless inability to answer any of them, we're all clearly looking in the wrong direction.
Well, kids do macro brilliantly, and that's the thing we're most frightened of as we age, isn't it? We just want to delve into the micro of everything, and just to, you know, I'm going to special. And all education is about funneling you into specialising. And the further you go educationally, the more kind of pinpoint your obsessions become. And maybe it should be the other way around. As you say, you know, you think, I think this kid's really good at languages. Let's do languages. Let's teach her. I don't know. She wants to do Mandarin and she wants to do Spanish. Great. And then by the time she's 15, she's doing everything.
Mm.
And actually, maybe we just get it the wrong way around. That's in a way how your learning has gone, I suppose.
Well, everyone at QI is a generalist. I mean, we all know that people have, some researchers have specialist knowledge, you know, in their, you know, some are physicists and some are done a lot of politics or whatever, but everybody can talk about anything, really. So my knowledge is very, very wide, but extremely shallow. And it basically consists of all the... consists as much of anything else as the things that we don't know. If you join all those up together, you know, why does a donkey have 78 chromosomes? You know.
That sounds like the beginning of a joke. It does, and that would be such a fiendish thing to try and find the punchline. I'll get back to you on that.
Yes, you.
But does it? I'm struck again by that image of you, 22 in a producer's chair.
Yeah.
There's so much expectation and pressure on your shoulders. Is that how you spent up till by your admission, sort of the age of 40, when you had this sort of epiphany?
I still suffer terribly from pressure. I don't know where it comes from. I feel, you know, I'm a perfectionist, kind of wanting to fix things all the time and, you know, to take on too much at once, that kind of thing. But, you know, it's a great, you know this, it's a really cool thing that both of us can spend a lifetime doing something that we originally did for fun, you know. Making people laugh is a lovely thing to try to do. It's very satisfying if you can do it. And so although I worked incredibly hard as a young radio producer, I really enjoyed myself, you know, and it's very difficult and it's very absorbing. But that, you know, it's one of the rules of life. If it isn't difficult, it's probably not really worth doing.
No.
I mean, making an omelette isn't difficult and is worth doing. But in terms of achieving something, the really good stuff takes a lot of effort, you know, to really a lot of you know, learning by your mistakes, changing your mind, getting better at it, practicing better.
Who were the people that most influenced you
when I was a kid,
or
just as a producer?
Life, yeah, ongoing, yeah.
I don't really know the answer to that. I'm not a big sort of hero worship person. I can't really think. I mean, I can think of individual people that you might not have heard of that, you know, you think, I respect that person because they've got integrity or because they work hard or because they're kind, that kind of stuff, but not really.
But you've collaborated a lot in your professional relationship. You've done a lot of working with.
Yeah, well, of course, I'm a producer. What else is there, though? Because, I mean, you know, it's that sort of thing in corporate offices, you know, they have these big signs saying teamwork, don't they? They don't mean it. But
no.
I mean, teamwork is working with small groups of people who get on. That's what QI is like. That's what film crews, a good film crew is like that. It's marvellous. You're a gestalt, you know. It's like, it's one mind working together with different areas of expertise. Yeah, it's like a film crew is like a human body, you know. You've got hands and feet and eyes and, you know, hearing and all that kind of stuff. But it walks about on its own, and it's a very satisfying thing when you, going back to that Chinese quote, I remember shooting, I got to know Alan Davis because I shot all these Abbey National ads when I was a director.
Yes, I forget you had a commercial win for a while.
Yeah, and Al and I got on very well, and I remember one particular shootout in South Africa where...
Oh, those were the days, John.
Yeah. And it was typically, you know, we open on a palm-fringed beach, off we go. And what that was it was meant to be an English country cottage. He was cycling down a country lane in England, and it was completely the wrong time of year to shoot it. So we went to South Africa and found a thatched pub and shot it there.
thatched pub in South Africa.
Yeah, it was sort of some eccentric thing. Yeah, only one. And I remember thinking that...
I'm just obsessed now with the way how to replicate sort of... Anyway, go on.
There was probably a bit of, you know, zhuzh here and there, I don't know. But I remember thinking that suddenly the film crew were essentially directing the entire thing themselves. And I had nothing to do because the storyboard was... I worked very hard on the storyboard. And they were just colouring it in, you know. You think, this is marvellous. People used to say to me, you must be really scared as a director when you go on the set and everyone wants to know what you think. And you say, no, it's completely the reverse. You feel a tremendous waft of support from underneath you. Because if you, as a director, if you've done your prep, that is, write the storyboard and make sure everything is in order and everything's, you've got a great producer and you're reasonably polite and pleasant, a film crew will do anything for you. And you don't really have to give orders or anything. They sort of do it. It's really good fun.
It helps that you're good at drawing so that you can storyboard everything beautifully.
Well, they're not beautiful, my storyboards, but they're sort of cartoons, really. They're quite funny, I think.
So in South Africa, by a thatched cottage, was how you met Alan?
I didn't meet him in South Africa, but yeah, that was one of them. We did several years of ads together, and that was just one of them.
So I wonder, I know everyone asks you about this, but I wanted to ask about Douglas Adams, who just has had such a profound effect on British comedy and comedy consciousness.
Yeah.
Were you at college together?
Yes, we were at next door colleges. He was a year below me. He was at St John's and I was at Trinity. And before either of us were in Footlights, which Douglas I don't think ever was, in fact, I ended up running the Trinity Review and Douglas ran the one at St John's because Footlights at that time didn't have a clubroom, so there was no centre to it. And Footlights, it had gone a bit absent, really. But the hot tickets were in college comedy. So we started out sort of more or less more rivals than friends, and we knew each other, but not very well. And we got friends after he came down, and we were as close as you can be, really. We were very, very close friends for several years and used to write together. And I eventually got a job as a producer, as I said, and Douglas and I shared a flat and then a little house with my girlfriend, so three of us. And you know, I'd rush home from work and we'd start writing things in the evening. So, yeah, I knew him very well.
And how much, I mean, bearing in mind you're saying there's always this cross-fertilisation in your work, you're very open-handed in the way that you deal with people. I mean, he died way too young. What of Douglas Adams remains in you, I guess? What of his sort of take, his feel, his life?
Yeah, I mean, it was an awful thing. I think unfinished business, really. I think like a lot of people who die before their time and you haven't resolved what you had to say to each other, which we didn't really. You know, because you probably famously know he sacked me from Hitchhiker after I helped him out in the first series, which was an awful experience and very hurtful and made me very cross and made him very cross and he was very hurt that I was cross and, you know, didn't understand why I was angry. And we patched it up and we went on working together from time to time, wrote a couple of books together. And I've since have cause to be really grateful for it because it made me do things that I wouldn't otherwise have done, you know. Because nearly everything that's happened to me in my life has been as a direct result of being sacked from something. So you're sacked from Footlights, sacked from Hitchhiker, sacked from London 9 o'clock News, sacked from Blackadder. There's almost nothing I've done that I haven't been sacked from by
somebody.
You sacked
yourself, though, didn't you, from Have I Got News? Didn't you sack
yourself? I sacked myself from that, that's true. So. I did.
It didn't run for long anyway, don't worry about it.
No, but again, you know, Sue, I think... I didn't want to really do it very much because I sort of felt I'd done that, you know, because I used to produce the news quiz and I'm hungry to do new things. I don't want to go on doing the same old, same old. It's enough to repeat the bad habits of, you know, of one's personality without having to repeat not have new experience at work, you know. And I like the business of moving on and trying something different. You know, so for example, QI runs, like, you know, runs extremely well without me now. I don't really have much to say in the running of the company. I have a lot to say about the series because, you know, go to research meetings like the first ones this afternoon and turn up to the show and do the funny buzzer noises, as you probably know. That's my main task as the executive producer.
No, you get to press the buzzer. You get all the good jobs. You mainly press them when I do it. I seem to remember, yes, falling into many of those pits in my time. You'd have been very busy on those shows.
But what I do, my main focus these days is managing my son's band, which is called...
What?
It's called Waiting for Smith. They're really, really good. He's going to Nashville on Sunday to record an EP, and then he's going to Hollywood to do a couple of gigs, and he's going to the Napa Valley to do three more, and he's going to be... I'd be very surprised if he's not world famous one of these days.
Wow, so which
son
is this?
Completely new, Harry.
This is Harry. Yeah. Is your eldest?
Yeah. Well, I only have one son, two daughters.
Okay, so what kind of music is it?
People, that's amazingly interesting. That's because that's the question people continually ask. And the answer is, it's good music.
Yeah.
But it doesn't follow any sort of genre.
It's not genre.
So he writes wonderful ballads. He does, he loves every kind of music, actually.
What's his instrument?
Everything, guitar and keyboards principally, but
he's sing.
Yeah, he sings and writes all the songs, and they're great, and they're all on Spotify and all that kind of stuff.
Oh man,
it's very,
so
very
I'm
exciting.
I'm going to listen to it. So you'll
like it. I mean, because it'll get into your bloodstream, because all the tunes. I've never personally met anyone who can write so many tunes with. Well, I've met Paul McCartney. So
he
I know
did,
he's pretty good.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
But no, has rights.
He'll be glad of that affirmation. You're saying your son is better than Paul McCartney.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I adulate Paul McCartney, but but he's got a thing which is, it's like he's from a different era, because it's interesting when he does. We did a bonfire party a couple of years ago, and you know, because it's a party, you want plenty of covers, you know, so people are familiar. Oh, it's Brown Sugar or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And what he would do is just drop in every two or three songs, he'd drop in one of his own, and you'd have the Travelling Wilburys, and there'd be something of Harry's, and then there'd be, I don't know, the Doors or something. And people say, well, what's the one in the middle? I know that tune.
That's
and he
great.
Has that peculiar quality that when you hear the song once, and it's as if you've known it all your life. It's really odd.
Was he always... I mean, you've said that parenting is about getting out of the way, really, and just allowing this wonderful young life to sort of flourish in an atmosphere of sort of positivity and curiosity. But did you notice that from an early age with him? Did you just think, okay, that one's a musician?
No. But I noticed very early on that he doesn't think in straight lines. You know, he found ordinary school, unlike me, he found ordinary schoolwork quite difficult, but he's extremely creative, you know, brilliant actor and very funny. And the music, he turned up, we went to a school concert, you know, one of those end-of-term concerts where everyone, you know, mucks about at prep school, you know, and makes fun of the teachers, that kind of thing. And Harry and three of his friends turned up, and they were a punk band. It's the most extraordinary thing, four 11-year-olds singing this song called Mind the Gap. Harry was on the drums, he was a drummer first. That's how he started, and I had no idea. They'd practiced in somebody's garage. Didn't even know the other guys played the guitar, you know. So it started then, and then he went off to main school and then became a ski instructor and sort of taught himself to play the piano about 18, I think, mainly from YouTube videos.
They're amazing, YouTube
and
videos.
And what I've definitely learned far too late, in Harry's case anyway, is that everything that Harry's done... he's done of his own accord. All the things that I've tried to suggest he might do or push him to do, he hasn't either wanted to or not been able to. But all these things, you know, it's remarkable. And that's what I think about learning is we've just taken on a new researcher on attachment for 6 months, young guy called Ethan. I was just talking to him about it just now, which is, the only stuff you really learn and remember and understand is the stuff you've done for yourself. That's the thing. That's why most of school is so hopeless. What it should be, as they say, the cliche is child-centered learning, is it? Find out what they want to do and encourage them to do it.
Which is exactly the thing about, you know, if you're not interested, you can't... it doesn't stick. The adhesive, the educational adhesive is lacking, so it doesn't permeate. It just falls off.
Yeah,
you know,
it's like
you with your times table.
Mm.
It's not that you're not interested in numbers. Numbers are endlessly fascinating. Mm. It's just the learning by rote, a sort of carousel of times tables. It's not just you didn't care about it, and it has virtually no real meaning in the real world. You're never required to use it. But sometimes you are required to sort of think about numbers and the importance of numbers and the constellation of numbers in your immediate environment. So yeah, but I don't know how you could roll out that in classrooms. That's the problem. As soon as you get to child-centred learning, you're dealing with 30 different children with 30
different... Well, first of a start, the people who... Teachers should be people not who really know their subjects, but people who like children. That would be the first start. The last time I did a podcast was with Dermot O'Leary, who's a friend of mine, a really good guy.
Mm.
And it was at the Wilderness Festival in Oxfordshire. And I was just waiting to, obviously, nobody knows who I am. I was talking to a couple of punters who were in the queue. And they were very funny and interesting and nice. And the woman had been a maths teacher for 23 years, has just got started in a new kind of educational project. And so I said, I hated maths at school. And she said, that's because you weren't taught properly. And that's all there is to say, isn't it? If you don't like any subjects because somebody hasn't found the key to make you find it interesting or attractive or amusing. And I remember going back to 11-year-olds. When I was 11, we had a brilliant maths teacher called Mike Pike, who was definitely the coolest dude in the school. You know, he was very laconic and very cool. And he taught us a game called NIM. You ever played this?
No.
Okay, NIM is you take any number of objects, coins or pebbles or matches, and you put them, lump them into random piles with different numbers of pebbles or matches in each pile. And then you can take away each move, you can choose any one pile, take as many as all of them, or just take one from the pile. And the object is to make the other person pick up the last object. Okay. I can show it's easier to show than to tell. The only way this is 1962 I'm talking about here. The only way you can win this game, and you will win it every single time, is if you understand binary mathematics, which in 1962, most people never heard of binary. So you have to understand binary and be able to add up binary in your head. And if you can do that, you'll win every single game. I used to win a lot of money right through school and university because it looks like such a simple game. It must be a random thing, but it isn't. It's absolutely foolproof. And
so how did you understand binary mathematics in 1962 then?
Because he explained how binary works.
So he was the one that just said, okay, this is how it...
Yeah, but the game came first. And he said, this is how to win the game. This is a thing called binary mathematics. And, instead of it being ones, tens, hundreds, it's just noughts and ones all the way. And of course, it's been fascinating because I've always loved puzzles and and games. So once learning's expressed as a game, and I never forgot it, of course, you know. And it was probably it was years and years before anybody knew anything about computing and noughts and ones and so on.
I feel that I'm lucky enough. The teacher that most transformed my life, I'm lucky enough to still know. And I did A level music, and I was the only person in my school doing it, so it was just me and her. And I used to find it really frustrating because so much of music is maths and a sort of structure and routine and then the breaking thereof, but it did my head in. And when I struggled, she would just say, I want you to write a project on architecture at this period of time and art. And so I'd go and do that, and then I'd become so interested in what was happening in art movements in the 1920s or something. Mm. I would then come back to what was happening in music, and I would understand Stravinsky, I always admired her. Of course, she could take the time with me because I was the only one doing it, but also to understand that this person doesn't learn in a conventional way. And for me, if you telescope out and get a slightly more broad picture of what's happening, I can then go back in with more interest and more clarity. Everyone talks about, they rioted at the Rite of Spring. But I wondered, well, why?
Mm.
Why would people do that? What's happening? Actually, weirdly, we're almost at that time in our history, in our political history, where that sense of explosiveness is upon us.
Yeah.
But I needed to I needed to have a more broader idea. So yeah, I was able to go back and say thank you, and that was, to get back to your idea of gratitude, very important for me.
I mean, this is so interesting that you come across these things yourself, but that learning by inference, learning by accident, of getting absorbed in something and realizing it has a connection to something totally other. Those things are really, because that is the way the world is. Everything is actually connected. Like, you know, your trees with all those amazing, you know, whatever the word is, the little fungi in the roots, yeah. And the, yeah.
And able to trees are able to, they have a sort of consciousness. They have a, there's that amazing story he gives in that book about three oak trees that are planted mere inches away from one another. So to a casual observer, it looks like one tree that has just simply got branches at its root and its base. It's three different trees and one changes colour before the others. And he's saying trees have different personalities. They're each having to work out, is this the end of summer? Are the days now substantially getting shorter? Is the light, is the heat dimming enough for me to just power down? And this one tree goes, it's time. And the other two trees wait. And they just want a little bit more sunlight. They want a little bit more. They're greedy. And actually their greed will mean they will fail sooner. But that idea that, which comes back to your idea of the collective consciousness, says that it's happening in nature all around us, and we don't even stop to marvel at it, not even for a second. But it is extraordinary. And I was so captivated. And so I finished that book and I was sort of moved to tears, really, that by my own stupidity and my own lack of curiosity.
But you've expressed that so well. Again, I was completely in the zone there. I was reading the book with you. I can see the stories are so pictorial. I absolutely... And this one-man show I did, Edinburgh, just going back to that, I sort of hated myself for taking it on because what a vain and silly thing to do and all that kind of stuff, and you find it very hard to write. And so I always start with what I'm interested in, what I was interested in at the time, and this is like, I don't know, 6 years ago, something like that, was plant intelligence, which then, even that short a time ago, was considered a bit of a weird idea that plants might be intelligent. We had a clematis in our garden at home in Oxfordshire, and I watched this thing climb up a treehouse, and I thought, if that isn't intelligence, I don't know what intelligence means, because it's clearly, it's like a mountaineer. You can see a little tendril going out there and another one there. So I became fascinated by this, and I came across this story that the idea that barley may be intelligent, because barley has very weak genes and can't survive in the wild. It has to be cultivated. And the theory goes that barley somehow persuaded human beings to domesticate it in order to give... So in return, it would give them beer. So the people looked after the barley and the barley make beer for the people. Rather like dogs, you know, domesticating. Mm. You know, a lot of people think that dogs domesticated people, not the other way around. I used to get laughed at. I mean, I'd give you the usual press round of interviews and things. People say, well, that's weird. Is that, you just make that up? So no, I think it's an interesting idea. Anyway, so that, a bit later on, I was chairing a conference in Cambridge, which was a BBC thing where they invited people who thought the media wasn't doing a very good job. And, you know, so there were people from all over the world who thought that the BBC didn't report South America very well, or there were people from farming who feel they didn't get, excuse me, a fair look in or something. And one of the guys there was a professor of botany from Cambridge called John Parker, who ran the botanical gardens at that time. And so he's a real expert on plants. You know, he likes plants more than people, does John, really. So, so I said to him, what do you think, John, about this idea that, I told him the story about barley being intelligent, and he turned on me and he's got these really steely blue eyes and he stared at me. He says, wheat doesn't give a fuck what you think.
If I had a title for every podcast ever made, it would be that.
But isn't it just fabulous, you know? And you suddenly think your world sort of peels apart like an orange, it explodes, and you suddenly, a whole new vista opens up. you know, you see John Parker going back to the botanical gardens and saying, right, you petunias, let's take the fort.
So some plants give a fuck and some just don't.
Yeah.
Give zero fucks,
yeah.
That thing about, I'm interested in the idea that dogs domesticated humans. The same way that pigs, they never think sort of livestock, particularly in places like Southeast Asia where pigs live with or in communities alongside humans, that they accept what's going to happen to them.
Do they?
There's this theory that because there's no... If you go to a small village in Vietnam, you'll see the house on stilts and underneath you'll have all the chickens and the pigs living together. And they've studied them and there's this feeling that the pigs know that they will be slaughtered. Not en masse, only when needed. The oldest pig will probably be culled first. But there is this accommodation made because they will be taken care of. They will be fed. They will be allowed. Their babies will be allowed to live, and they will see them reach, you know, certainly a reasonable level of maturity. And that's this that's the strange sort of.
How do they know this?
Because the pigs could go. They could go and they could forage and they could widen their... I mean, it might be that just pigs are very stupid, but all research kind of tends to say that they're not. They could move away from the village with great ease. These villages are very, very small. And they could set up colonies away and live and sustain, but they, for some reason, they seem to like being with people, even if that means at some point they will be killed by one of them. Strange.
That is really fascinating.
So what does that mean about all our relationships with animals? And is there always a sort of mortality endgame that they're factoring in as they spend time with us?
Well, also, it's a kind of really interesting metaphor for human existence because another strange thing about being a person is that everybody thinks they're immortal until somebody dies and it catches everyone by surprise every time, doesn't it?
Every time.
My mum's 99. She's just been through a bit of a crisis. We thought, you know, she was... might have only lasted a few days, a couple of weeks ago. She seems to be okay now. But the fact that it's surprising all the time, and if the pigs, in pig philosophy, it's like, well, look, everybody dies. We might as well have a nice life while we do it. And that's what I was going back to earlier. The important thing is to live now. It's no good going worrying about what will happen tomorrow or what happened last week. The thing is to live now and be grateful for what you have and then... because you can't escape the mortality thing. And the pigs say, well, we embrace this willingly. It's like, you know, having a memento mori on your desk, isn't it? The skull on your desk to remind you every day you haven't got forever. So use the time properly. So I'm with those pigs. I kind of like that.
So you'll live close to humans. You'll be fed, you'll be watered. We'll give you a bun, we'll give you a flat white. And when the time comes, it'll be a shock to everyone.
Yeah.
May that day be long. John, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with me.
Thank you, sir. It's been lovely.
When the pillars have been restored and the churches there are no more.
All the music in this episode was provided by Waiting for Smith. And if you want to check out more Waiting for Smith, then go to Spotify.
If you want me to. When the marble has turned to clay, and the people have all turned grey, and the Romans don't walk so slow, I'll be there if you want me to. I'll be there if you want me to.